this generation really only knows lots of things that they were told were conventional that have turned out to not be. And I think it's allowing them to say, all right, you know what? There really is no blueprint. Life does not have a plan. There's no real, like, path you're supposed to be on. And it's a challenge. But I think it's going to mean people spending more of their best years working on the stuff they actually love.
It's How to Be Amazing from PRX. I'm Michael Ian Black. In 2005, Alexis Ohanian co-founded Reddit, a social media platform slash news aggregator slash cat pick repository slash whatever you want it to be, that eventually became known as the front page of the internet, now ranked among the 50 most trafficked sites on the internet. Reddit began its life in a kind of roundabout way as a way to order food from your cell phone. Less than 2 years after its founding, Alexis sold Reddit to Condé Nast Publications, making him a millionaire by the age of 23. He's now started a slew of other web startups and is the author of the 2013 book, Without Their Permission. Alexis believes the internet is no longer just for the Bill Gateses and Mark Zuckerbergs of the world. The internet is now a launch pad, a place where anyone with an idea can turn their passion into a living. Today on the program, I ask Alexis how to navigate this exciting and volatile new reality. And then I lay down some wisdom of my own. I think you have to try to just impregnate an elephant. And I think you have to be passionate about those elephants, each and every one of them.
That is not going to end well for you.
Alexis Ohanian, welcome to How to Be Amazing.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with Reddit.
Mm-hmm.
It's known as the front page of the internet. Now, despite the fact that hundreds of millions of people are visiting this thing, for my listeners who aren't familiar with Reddit, mm-hmm. and despite my description of it, can you explain what it is and how people use it?
Sure. Well, you kind of nailed it with the cats. Reddit is a platform for online communities to share links and have discussions. And it's basically next generation forum software. Web forums have been around forever. That's a lot of where Steve and I got our inspiration from. We just realized, okay, we can make it possible so that anyone can sort of spin up one of these forums, one of these subreddits. And now there's almost 500,000 of them talking about everything from cats to a particular species of cats to, My Little Warhammer, which is a community of people who love both My Little Pony and Warhammer.
Right, those people.
Obviously. And
I am a proud member.
I salute you, sir. It's a fabulous community and one I said of hundreds of millions. And we realized one of the best ways for them to share links and have discussions was through this kind of submitting technique with upvotes and downvotes. And Steve engineered all this. And it's become everything based on that simple little idea.
Now, if you're not familiar with it, what happens is a kind of question, query, a link, a statement, a picture gets posted to Reddit. And then you, the viewer, has the opportunity to upvote it, which means you just click an up arrow, or downvote it, which is just a down arrow. And then based on the popularity, those items can kind of move up in popularity. There is a kind of democratization going on the internet, and that is the kind of thesis of your book, Without Their Permission. Can you talk about that democratization and where you see the opportunities and challenges?
Sure. Well, for me, it has been a privilege, right? I got my first internet connection as a middle schooler. My parents got me a 33.6 modem, and I got to build websites on GeoCities that anyone in the world could see. And this was this permissionless innovation, sort of where I got the title of the book. That's always defined what the internet has allowed, right? If you've got a great idea to start a podcast, no longer do you need to have the means for a radio station or have the means for a television studio. You can just sort of get started and create it. And while the world, let me be very clear, the world is obviously not democratic, right? Society has all kinds of imbalances that are not equitable. But the technology of the internet, of the open internet, really is where all bits are created equal, which is, you know, a core to net neutrality, is democratic in nature, in the sense that, you know, one of us with an idea, it could be on our little lonely WordPress blog. If enough people want to see it, if enough people like it, millions of people can read it. More people could read that little WordPress blog than something on the front page of the New York Times. What the internet does, and why I was more excited in this book to talk about other people than like the Reddit story, is that people who are entertainers, people who are artists.
For the record, he pointed at me.
Oh, yes, right. You can't see this. This is radio.
I am very entertaining. Oh, yes. Continue.
they have these opportunities now to be entrepreneurial. They don't want to be the next Zuckerberg. They don't want to start the next startup. But they want to do – they want to – this sounds so hokey, but they really want – they want to do the things they're passionate about and find a way to make a living from it. And thanks to the internet and thanks to really maybe the last 5 to 10 years of infrastructure. By that, I mean, you know, YouTube's made the cost of hosting videos zero and trivial. And then from a funding standpoint, things like Kickstarter, things like Patreon, which is another full disclosure company I backed, are allowing artists and allowing people to find their own hustle, right? There's one in particular. These two women met on Etsy. They lived in St. Louis. They found each other's jewelry amazing. They started collaborating. Now they've opened a store in downtown St. Louis together based on all the revenue they got from their Etsy stores. Like, that wasn't supposed to happen. Internet was supposed to put brick and mortar out of business, game over, when in fact it's letting people like these two women in the stores, Scarlet Garnet, shameless plug, they've got great jewelry.
Did you invest in them too?
I did not invest in them. I would have told you. but I love their story because they were able to take that low barrier to entry and just throw some stuff out there. And it turns out these women would have been amazing jewelers. And 20 years ago, everyone would have told them at Christmas, like, oh, your jewelry's so amazing, you should do a store. And they'd be like, well, how do I – like, bank's not going to give me a loan for that. I can't do that. And we would have never known the benefit of their great jewelry. And that's one example of so many. And now when you consider all the other disciplines that are letting people – get that access to the world through the internet. It means better stuff.
Were you always entrepreneurial? Was that always in your blood, or was there somebody in your life who pointed you towards that?
So my dad was a travel agent for pretty much forever. Yeah, his first like kind of steady job here in New York was as a travel agent, and he just fell into the industry. And then while I was in high school, just before the first dot-com boom, he started his own agency. At a time when, what was it, Travelocity, all these online travel agencies were basically putting travel agents like him out of business. To his credit, though, he just adapted his business, and it's still around. He's doing very well. He's got his little office, 3 employees, and they serve a very niche audience that is, like, scared to book stuff on the internet. Mm-hmm. And they need someone on the phone to walk them through their first cruise vacation. But I saw that, and I thought, man, this is so cool. Like, my dad's got his little business. He's his own boss. He works a lot, but, like, it demystified it for me a ton. And yet, by the time I got to UVA as a history major, I thought, oh, I'll be a lawyer. I'll be an immigration lawyer. That's what I want to do. My mom was actually an illegal for a couple years from Germany. It's those Germans ruining this country with their
taking all our jobs.
I know. But she was undocumented for a few years here in New York, and then my dad put a ring on it. But pro tip, that's what happened. And I guess for whatever reason, I was like, oh, history major, lawyer, this kind of makes sense. Immigration law, this is something meaningful to me. And then I was on a course for that. And I went to a Waffle House that changed my life.
So what happened at that Waffle House?
I left an LSAT prep course to go get these waffles because I was just hungrier for waffles than I was for the law. And I was there with my good friend Jack, and we both realized, like, do we really want to be lawyers? It's going to be 3 years, a lot of money, a lot of time. And we had started getting to know.
But at least at the end of it, you'd have a job you hate.
Maybe, right? That's the you'd think lawyers would be the one industry in this country that you'd never have a shortage. But I know a couple of lawyer friends who are like struggling to find gigs.
I'm sure.
I think about that a lot. I very easily could have been an immigration lawyer, and I lucked out because I walked out, and then I had that friend in Steve who he had a software job lined up for him in Virginia, just a little software company. And the two of us had always talked about things we wanted to build. And I came back to him and was like, dude, I don't want to be a lawyer. Like, let's start a company. And he was like, that's crazy. And I just wore him down. Mm-hmm. Sucker. and we started a company together. And I've been riding his coattails ever since.
Smart.
Yeah.
So walk me through that. You think to yourself, all right, I've got this buddy, Steve. I have this passion to start a company. I don't know what that company is, but I want to be my own boss. I want to be entrepreneurial. Maybe I want to make a lot of money. At the time, this is what, 2004, 2005, there is no kind of easy access to the internet in the same way, as you said, in the last 5 years or so, it's gotten easier. So how do you take that next step?
It was, here speaking of Morgan Fortune, once I convinced Steve we were going to do something, it was a matter of figuring out the idea. And he had always hated waiting in line at Sheetz, which is this gas station, I think in Virginia and most of the South, that lets you order. You walk in, you order from a touchscreen, or at least you used to back in 04. And back then, that was amazing. You could just touch, 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 sandwich shows up. And he thought, well, they've already got the touchscreen technology. Let me just order it from my phone so I don't even have to walk in. Like, it can just order it and then walk in and pick it up. As he's explaining this to me, I'm like, dude, you don't just need this at a gas station. You could use this anywhere with, you know, whether it's your Frappuccino or whatever, your Whopper. And so we started working on this with Ernest by the summer of our junior.
Now, who's Ernest?
He's a nice friend of ours. Really, really hard worker. Much harder worker than the rest of us. And then we thought, all right, this could be it. We're going to build this. We're going to call it My Mobile Menu, or MMM.
I like that.
Work in progress. But I really thought, okay, we're on to something. I had a professor at UVA, Professor Mark White, who I pitched this idea to. And he said, you know what? Not terrible. I get pitched a lot of stuff. I think it could work. And so I sent this email to Steve the very next morning with new resolve and new conviction. I found it. It's pretty embarrassing because it has lots of bros in it. I don't know what I was thinking at the time. I don't normally talk that way or type that way. But for whatever reason, this historical artifact from the founding of Reddit is full of bros. And I'm forever ashamed of it.
But I'm so sorry on your behalf.
It will haunt me. But that was it. It was a professor who just said, yeah, okay, let me get you some resources. Let me show you some books. And then this guy, Paul Graham, who at the time he'd become this kind of like internet pundit.
Mm-hmm. A guru
of sorts. Yeah, so he'd write these essays, not blog posts, but essays every few weeks. Paul had sold his company during the first boom. And he was clearly a smart dude who thought a lot about startups and technology. And Steve knew of him. And we saw that. This was during our senior year spring break. This guy, Paul Graham, was giving a talk in Cambridge at Harvard called How to Start a Startup. And we're like, wow, that's perfect. Like, that is what we are trying to do. We have no idea. This seems like an appropriate talk. It is during our senior year spring break.
Mm-hmm.
So why not go to Boston?
That's the place to
be. What else would we do? And
why not go to academia on spring break?
You know, because look, There's way too much screen glare on the beach. It's hard to use a laptop. Wi-Fi connectivity is usually terrible. And we thought, let's go. And we heard him speak. And afterwards, Steve got an autograph. And he brought a book that Paul had written and got him to sign it. And then I followed and I pitched Paul on coming out for a drink with us. We said, we came all the way from Virginia. And I think he was shocked that, like, we could get from Virginia to Boston. I don't know what that was, a commentary on, like, transportation methods in the South. But he was really shocked we'd come from Virginia. And he was like,
you boys take
a
mule train up here? How did you possibly?
How is this possible? he came around, though. And he said, all right, well, I'll meet you later tonight. And we met him for coffee. And it was a huge turning point for us because here was this guy who Steve really respected, who was very well known in developer circles, who told us, your idea is actually not terrible. We thought, damn, yes, amazing, not terrible. Like, this is high praise coming from him. And then within, I'd say, 3 weeks after that meeting, he announces Y Combinator, which was this experiment in early stage investing in tech startups.
And Y Combinator is it's a company?
It's a venture capital firm.
Uh-huh.
What makes Y Combinator different, what made it so unique back then, was they realized what had happened in the last few years was the cost of starting a company was now basically zero. This is largely because of open source software. In the first dot-com boom, it was all proprietary, to pay a lot of money. Thanks to open source and developers donating their time to write amazing code, two UVA graduates who had no connections could start a website for basically free. Just have to pay for hosting, which was less than our rent. And so he thought, you know what? Maybe startups don't need as much money to get started. What if we just give them a small amount of money? We give them 3 months of these intense weekly meetings where they're among their peers. We invest in maybe two dozen or a dozen or two startups. And they're all meeting once a week for dinner. We bring an interesting speaker to kind of tell them how to do startup law or how to do this or that. And then send them back out in the world for the rest of the week to go write code and get users. And then bring them back the next week and have them show off what they've built. And it became this like summer camp for startups. And at the time, it was just this lark. Like, it was Paul and Jessica and Trevor and Robert, these four friends, who thought they might be onto something. It was just kind of an experiment. Now it's invested in some of the most successful companies around. Forget Reddit. Dropbox, Airbnb. Those both started just like Reddit did, with these small checks. And those are now multi-billion dollar companies. It's phenomenal because they saw this before anyone else, and this was 05, and there was just so many fewer resources, and as a result, I mean, Steve and I did a lot of stupid stuff that we look back on now and facepalm about because there just was more, there was more naivete. There was no Twitter. There is such a wealth of knowledge now that's available from experts in the field that a founder today can look to so many resources and so many people to avoid mistakes their predecessors
made. It's amazing to me that we can be in 2014 and talk about 2005, 2006 as an epoch like ago.
Yeah. On the internet, it kind of was.
I know. And it seems like time is just speeding up on the internet as well.
Yeah. And it's exhilarating. It is terrifying. It's all of those things. I think part of the reason I'm so addicted to it, I mean, the internet is one thing because of the cats, but the industry is because there is no blueprint, because everyone is frantically writing it as we're doing it. And then as we're writing it, more stuff is changing. And it's, like I said, it's the thing that gives me a lot of hope, because what it means is you now have this infinite library for ideas. The library is so incredibly valuable. Like, Even things I now take for granted, like YouTube didn't exist when I was in college. Mm-hmm. And I go to these college students and I'm like, YouTube did not exist when I was in college. And I can watch their brains explode, because even something as basic as that, whether I'm struggling with Photoshop or whether I'm trying to soft boil an egg, which is difficult. Okay.
You don't have to tell me, brother. Right? You don't have to tell me.
Like, there are amazing tutorials from I'm in a way kind of happy that this generation, I don't want to say takes it for granted, but there is a different perspective.
When you say
on
this
learning.
Generation, you're 30 what?
I'm 31.
So are you including yourself in this generation?
You're barely.
Saying, right. You're saying the
generation
up and
coming up.
Right.
Yeah, because I, you know, getting a 33.6 modem in middle school changed my life, but it was a dial up. You know, I'd yell at my mom when she picked up the phone and I was playing my video games. But like.
Right. It used to be that a generation was 20, 25 years. A generation now really isn't that, in terms of technology and in terms of entrepreneurship and the kind of resources that you have available. The people you're talking about are probably 10 years younger than you.
Yeah. And they, most of them have known an internet connection, especially a broadband internet connection, their entire lives. And they've known connectivity, right? When they have a question, and whether it's, you know, a question with Pokemon or a question with their calculus, they just go to the internet because they know there's a resource there and they know there's an answer there. And that's at the heart of, like, that's at the heart of learning and knowledge, whether you want to be an entrepreneur or not. Like, if you can have that kind of aptitude and that curiosity and be able to fulfill it like that, it just means so much more progress. I think that's why it feels like everything's accelerating so much quickly, because we've always stood on the shoulders of giants. Now it's just we can do a lot more shoulder standing a lot faster.
When technology is changing so fast and you're peering into your own future, how do you begin to make sense of how to build a life for yourself, how to build a career for yourself? I'll take an example from my own life, which I've seen. This has changed so dramatically in my life. When I decided I wanted to be an actor, it was a kind of stupid decision. Everybody acknowledged in my family, this is a terrible decision because you'll never have any job security. Since the crash of 08 and even before that, we saw that that kind of security has been lost all across the board. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of interruptions, those kinds of cataclysmic disruptions in your own personal life are becoming more and more the norm. So if you're 15 years old, how do you begin to think about a career?
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Okay. So this is, I think, one of the great assets of this generation. And I know it's...
Haha, you said ass.
And I know it's... And I don't want to sound like I'm just spinning all this shitty stuff that happened, because, right... If you think of the, like, there was, so I was in college when 9/11 happened and two wars were started under very, very, very shaky pretexts, right? We have had so many things we were told not really live up to the sunlight of truth. We've had the belief that, right, everyone should own a home, right? And you've got the fallout from that, right? You talk about the economic crash and trusting these financial institutions, these banks. The student loan debt situation. Don't worry, go to school, get those loans. There'll be a job waiting for you. This generation really only knows lots of things that they were told were conventional that have turned out to not be. And I think it's created a certain amount of skepticism, I mean, and cynicism, but I think the skepticism is the really healthy part. And it's the fact that, yeah, you know, a 15-year-old today doesn't look out on the world with the same certainty that even a 15-year-old you or me did, because they just know, you know what? I'm not going to take anything for granted. I'm going to probably have to hack it. I'm going to have to find a way to make what I want out of this situation, because I'm expecting nothing. I'm not expecting a lot. And what I hope it does is every previous generation has had to either by without either either because it was easy or because they had to follow careers that were sort of prescribed for them, either because out of necessity they just had to take that job to do what they needed to do, or because, oh, well, here's this thing, you know, you graduate and you go work for 30 years and then maybe, you know, at that one job, and then maybe one day you can do your passion, you can do the thing you really care about. And I think what has happened now is because they can get started on it now, because hobbies that start out today, like taking a silly little Vine video, can end up, you know, having helping you build an audience of millions of people who love the stuff you're making or whatnot. It's allowing them to say, all right, you know what? There really is no blueprint. Life does not have a plan. There's no real, like, path you're supposed to be on. And I have more resources than anyone else ever could have dreamed of. So let me take advantage of them. And I think that's the great asset of this generation coming up, because that 15-year-old is not going to look at the world thinking, well, here's what I need to do, right? I'm interested in history, so obviously I'm going to become a lawyer and I'm going to do what I need to do there, and I'll do immigration law because that's interesting to me. And then maybe 30 years from then, I'll work on what I love. They're going to be like, no, you know what? I actually like doing this. I'm going to try that out for a little bit. I actually like doing that. I'm going to try it out. And hopefully find ways to hack that into full-time livings. And it's a challenge, but I think it's going to mean people spending more of their best years working on the stuff they actually love and getting in those 10,000 hours a lot sooner.
So your book is a lot about the kind of disruptive power of this democratization and how and we read every day about how certain industries, the publishing industry, the music industry, have been totally transformed and in most cases shrunken by this democratization. You know, I think we all know about those kids who are precocious and, you know, set up an app and sell it for $3 million by the time they're 13 years old. But that's a very small slice of the population.
Definitely.
What about those kids who don't have that kind of entrepreneurial spirit and yet look out in the world and don't see the same kind of opportunities that their parents had and their grandparents had? What happens to those kids?
That's what we need to figure out. I mean, I think there are more ways than ever now, and there are emerging new sort of new platforms, new ways to make a living doing these kinds of unorthodox things. Like, there really are artists right now making, you know, $5,000-$10,000 a month from their patrons on Patreon. These are people who basically said, you know what, here's a dollar every month, it's recurring, just for you to do what you do, for you to make a cappella videos of video game theme songs. That's a guy. I think he pulls about $4,000 or $5,000 a month to do this.
Oh, and God, I'm in the wrong line of work.
I mean, you just have to find your niche, right? Like, these things are emerging. That one didn't exist 6 months ago. That platform didn't even exist 6 months ago. I mentioned Etsy and these storefronts. I think there are going to be things that look unorthodox because they are, and because there's no real precedent for them. But we're going to find ways. And what's crazy is, so it's a huge opportunity, right? It means that, you know, someone can start something from their dorm room like Steve and I did, and it really can, you know, have this profound impact 5-10 years later. There are so many other stories that are happening now that are going to be even bigger. And it's great that that can happen faster and easier than ever. You don't need to open a factory. You just open your laptop. That's great. But the curse of that gift is that it's going to require fewer and fewer people to be part of this new workforce. One of the clear trends that's already started, one of the reasons I went across the country talking about learning to code as a core skill set in this generation or in this century, is because by its nature, software reduces the need for human labor. Like, if a developer, if she's sitting there finding herself doing the same thing over and over again, she writes code, so she doesn't have to do it over and over again. And so that's the big challenge. And I don't have answers for it. I know that there is a huge push, and there it cannot be understated or overstated, a huge push to get people learning to code, especially in this generation coming out of college, because that's the most valuable skill in demand right now. And going forward, there are going to be so many jobs that are frankly replaced by robots, right? Like, and that's a challenge, because our economy needs people to be working. We need to find ways to make this work. And I've worked enough of those jobs as waiters, as box movers, as I worked at a parking garage. Like, every one of those jobs is in some way going to be scaled back by technology. And that's going to mean lots of innovation, and that's going to mean job creation and value creation, but it's also going to mean fewer people with jobs to do. And I don't know what the future looks like.
I've spent a lot of time on the Reddit subcategory Futurology.
Oh, yeah.
Which spends a lot of time talking about this.
Yeah.
And it does seem like people are giving this a lot of thought, and there's a lot of challenges inherent in it. You mentioned coding as a solution, and to that end, you've started or maybe helped start something called Code Academy.
Mm-hmm. Invested in it.
Invested in it.
I can't.
That's even better than starting it, because then you're just writing a stupid check,
yeah.
And you're like,
yeah. You don't do any real work,
right? You're like, yes. I own this now. What is Code Academy?
So Code Academy, you can go on right now, codeacademy.com, and it through your browser lets you get started learning how to code. And they've sort of they've like gamified it, so it's a really easy process for people who said, "Oh, I could never learn how to code. I can't do it." It really try it, and you find yourself completing these tutorials, and by the end of it, you actually have a foundation for learning to code. And what's so powerful about it is whether it's my co-founder Steve Huffman, whether it's Mark Zuckerberg, any of these people, they are all largely self-taught. Once you can get the kind of fundamentals, then the internet becomes your classroom. And so if you want to learn the latest in web development strategies for mobile, like, you just start a Google search. That's how everyone does it. And Code Academy is one way to lower the barrier. There are plenty of programs happening between the nonprofit world and the for-profit world. They're trying to get people to get their hands into code, ideally as young as possible, right? Because kids, man, you taking the subway here, like, you can see every kid is on his mobile phone. They're on their mobile phones playing some kind of game. That's a hook. That was what got me into writing code, was playing like too much Quake. And then once I realized I could like make my own Quake, well, not exactly, but I could make something that was potentially this much fun, I got hooked. And I hope mobile gaming can be a way to get kids into it.
Earlier in the show, Alexis mentioned a video game theme a cappella artist, and that is who we're listening to right now. If you like what you hear, you can check out Smooth McGroove on YouTube and even request a cover of your favorite Zelda theme. This is How to Be Amazing. Today, we're talking to Alexis Ohanian, the founder of Reddit, about a revolution that has been happening in the last few years on the internet. Alexis is a champion of entrepreneurship as a way for everyday people to make money doing the things they care about. But that new reality also comes with significant challenges. Coming up, Alexis and I talk about failure, when to give up, and why we may need to fight harder than ever to keep the internet the even playing field we depend on it to be. Are there rules for starting businesses that don't change as the times change?
Yes. The best one that YC taught us from like day one, it was on the t-shirts they gave us. That's probably why it's seared into my brain, is make something people want. And it seems very self-evident, right? How could you possibly have a company that makes something people want? But it's interesting because I think this is a really good time for these kinds of values that really seem evident, but somehow washed away over the last, I don't know, 50 years of PR and marketing. There are so many industries that have been able to get away with things that aren't actually, like, I mean, the bottled water industry, for crying out loud. Like, there are so many industries that have really manufactured this kind of demand. And if you put them under some scrutiny, like, there's no, like, they haven't necessarily made something people want. They've just made something they've convinced people wanted. And that's always kind of part of the equation. But on the internet, where attention spans are so short, whether you are a jeweler starting your Etsy store or whether you're someone trying to create the next Twitter or whatever, you really have to make something people want, because you don't start out with a multi-million dollar ad budget to cover a city in billboards.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second.
Sure.
Because when you say make something people want, in a sense, is that the same thing as saying make, if I'm speaking to myself, make mm-hmm. something I want? I mean, how do you second guess your audience? How do you project out into the world and say, the world wants this? It seems like such a nebulous idea.
I would start I think the best founders start with something they want.
Mm-hmm.
Or the best, I mean, the best comics, the best whatever. Like, you start with making something you would want. I think maybe, I mean, this is an interesting test, right? 50 years ago, it may not have been possible for people to have these kinds of micro communities where maybe what they want is that really niche thing. It's a really niche type of humor, a really niche type of artwork, a really niche type of whatever that they're creating, and it would have been much harder to find an audience for it. And today, again, because of the internet, right, you can have a community of people who love you for your My Little Pony Warhammer art. I think you have to start with making something that you want. But there is the risk, there is the reality that maybe what you want is something really only like six other people want. And
right.
It's probably not enough to
and
make
And yet you
happy.
Look around at some of the huge successes of the last even couple years. You look at something like 50 Shades of Grey, for example, which started
mm-hmm.
online.
Mm-hmm.
Is that woman going, I think what the world wants is, you know, sort of softcore female erotica? As it turns out, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The guy who writes Flappy Bird, is he thinking what people want is like a 1981-looking game that's incredibly hard and you get 1 point at a time? As it turns out, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels to me – look, obviously nobody can predict the future. It feels to me that as a creative person, I like to think myself, the best way to go about it is to – is, as you just said, identify a need within yourself that you can fill, and hopefully you'll find that audience.
Mm-hmm. And know that it is a numbers game, right? Like, even – so Flappy Bird is such a great story because that wasn't – so that definitely was not his first game, and it didn't even – it didn't have its moment until many months after it was on the App Store, and then it got picked up by some reviewer who lampooned it, who was like, this is the worst game ever. And interestingly enough, that sort of set it off, right? It is a numbers game in that you can't – and everyone's always, how do you make stuff go viral? Like, there's no – no matter how many cats you put in it, you can probably do some things to sort of increase the chances of it happening, but not materially. It's a numbers game. Create as much stuff that you are excited about, that you're proud of, and put it out into the world, because that's going to increase the odds of someone stumbling on it and hopefully – you know, setting it off.
My friend has an example or a saying about this, because in my business, as I was saying, it's exactly the same thing where you never know what's going to hit. You never know what's not going to hit. And so you try to, excuse the indelicate language, fuck as many elephants as possible in the hopes that you'll get one of those elephants pregnant.
Do elephants have trouble getting pregnant?
I don't know.
Why an elephant?
I don't know.
All right.
I don't know, but it was such a nice image.
I have so many questions. All right.
I held it with me. And I think that's right. I mean, I think you have to try to just impregnate an elephant. And I think you have to be passionate about those elephants, each and every one of them.
For listeners, just do not try to impregnate an elephant without the elephant's consent. That is not going to end well for you.
No, it probably won't.
If you don't ask nicely.
But I think that's right. And I wonder if – is that what's spurring your sort of current life as
an
investor?
I'm impregnating elephants. Yeah, in a way. I mean, you are absolutely right to point out that writing checks is not at all hard work or real – like worth praising. Like it's not. It's really not. But I see it – really. I mean, as an investor and an advisor, I hope that – yes, I hope one of these companies IPOs one day, and I hope it's a nice return. But really, the first rule of quote unquote angel investing, which is such a misnomer because no one's really an angel. Really, who? Obviously, an angel. Obviously, a rich person came up with that and was like, "We are going to call ourselves angel investors."
Yeah.
As he adjusted his monocle, like
it's better than rich dude.
You should.
We're going to call ourselves rich dudes.
Just rich people. But you know the first rule of it is as soon as you write that check, it's gone. And so it really is statistically. You're losing that money. The odds of this, you know, returning are so incredibly slim. You're throwing it away. But you're doing it for like the startup karma because you know a couple of founders, they're just like you. They were in the same position you were in. Like it's the least you can do. And it feels really great.
You talked about writing a check and basically knowing that most of the time that money's going down the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
So the flip of that is those people who are getting the check.
Mm-hmm.
Most of their companies are going to fail.
Yeah.
And they know that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the role of failure both in your own life and as you see it kind of in the larger community?
Well, Steve and I lucked out because we failed very early in. So a year into My Mobile Menu, when we applied to Y Combinator, we were rejected. And they said, it's too early for mobile. At this point, it was like 2005. So like the BlackBerry was the smartest phone on the market, which is, no, too soon. Poor BlackBerry. But... It wasn't, it was too early for this. And they said, sorry, we're not going to invest. And the next morning called us back and said, listen, we still don't like your idea, but if you change it, do something in a browser instead of on a mobile phone, we'll let you in. We'll invest. And we killed our idea right there. Got on the train, went back to Boston, and spent an hour with Paul and agreed to build something that would approximate what would become Reddit. And so a year into this company, I'd talked to every restaurateur in Charlottesville, Virginia. We'd started sketching out a prototype, and we killed it because we realized, you know what, it's just the timing's off.
But wait, let me stop you for a second, because in a way that runs contrary to a lot of advice I've heard, which is you've got an idea and you're passionate about it, and somebody tells you no.
Right.
You just wave the white flag and be like, yeah, okay, no.
Yeah, that's true.
When all the advice that I hear is you got to pursue it. You got to push through it.
There is, and I'm guilty of giving that advice too. Okay, here is the common wisdom, and I say this all the time, is that, you know, great founders are relentless, and they'll hear no lots of times until they show the world that no, actually it is yes. The difference is, there is relentless, where you're trying the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, which I think is the definition of insanity. And then there's relentlessness where you're trying something, it doesn't work, and then you decide, okay, here are five other things we can do. And you try those five things, and one of them kind of works. And you're like, okay, this seems like we're on something. You try five more things. We don't want founders who are obviously doing the former, where they're just running their head in the wall. And I think for us, because the problem with our startup was so fundamental, because if we wanted people to order food from their cell phones, the technology that existed in that day was going to dictate how it was going to work. And at that time, either we were only going to serve a handful of people with Blackberries, and Blackberry had an app store back then. Like, this was just a different world. So getting the app to them would have been
basically
really hard.
The Flintstones era.
Yes. I mean, that's how the train we took was pedaled by our feet. It was a hard time.
No wonder Paul didn't understand how you got from Virginia to Boston.
Exactly. It was exhausting. And then the rest of the market would have just been using, I don't know, SMS. Like, it would have been really janky. And so I think the asterisk on that is, it's okay to quit if what is brought to your attention is a, like, huge structural problem in your startup.
Right.
So that's when it's okay to call it quits. And that was when we knew, all right, you know what, that year was wasted. I mean, we learned from it, but it was a failure. And you know, founders – and look, starting a startup, starting a company is not for everyone. And that's fine. There are, like – I'm obviously pushing people, like, that's where I start with, because I want to encourage as many people to feel like they can do what I did, because it's like, fuck, if I can do this, like, seriously, you can do this. And then even if they just end up, you know, getting jobs somewhere or doing, like, that's great too. But I think for the people who get into it, they know failure is very likely. But the way they look at it is, well, this is certainly a better investment than 2 years at business school, because that's really expensive and you don't learn anything. Management. Business Associates, whatever that, MBA, whatever that stands for. I didn't go to fancy MBA school. I don't need to know what it stands for.
Masters of Business Administration.
There we are. Which is malarkey. Like, I always tell people, if you do want to go down this road, don't get the MBA, because 2 years into your company, even if it's a total failure, as long as you weren't, like, embezzling the money or using it for, like, Coke and strippers, you're going to be able to go to a job or another investor and be like, here's what I did for the last 2 years. And starting a company looks way better than I went to Harvard Business School. And it's a much more rational decision. And I know it seems crazy, but if you want to get into entrepreneurship, MBA is not the way to do it. So failure is an option as long as you're doing it, like, as long as you're sort of failing for the right reasons. But at the end of the day, I hope it just means more people getting into creation. I want to see more people thinking. I don't want people to just think of themselves as consumers, because everyone is capable of creating stuff. And who knows what it is, right? It could be haikus. It could be startups. It could be, I don't know, cooking. It could be whatever. But like, there is a stage now and a library that is this amazing resource. And I want as many people making stuff on it as possible.
Do you think creativity is a kind of is an inherently human condition?
As in, like, exclusive to
exclusive to humans necessarily, but is creativity sort of part of our DNA? Is it something that we have to do?
I want to believe so. I think so. I have obviously not studied this enough.
No, it's nice to think so.
I think
so. Let's just agree
that
it's nice to think so.
I want to believe so because, okay, I am absolutely certain that for all of the amazing creativity, all the amazing stuff we've, you know, humans have produced, right? It is still just a fraction of all the stuff humans could have produced if it weren't for the fact that all kinds of other things held back fuck tons of people who would have been amazing creators and doers and sharers. And the internet does not, it's not like a magic wand. It doesn't, woo, yay, it's all gone. But it does enable more people faster and I think more efficiently than anything we have seen in terms of like technological or whatever change, societal change, to allow that change to happen and allow us to benefit from more potential creators than we ever could have. And that is exciting to me because I think we're going to see if it really bears out.
And so now we're dealing, as you've mentioned several times, with net neutrality. And you're currently fighting for net neutrality. Can you briefly explain what neutrality is and why it's so important?
Sure. Okay, so net neutrality means that all bits are created equal. So, you know, we all have tubes going into our house that have internet. And net neutrality ensures that Comcast or Verizon or Time Warner, whoever your internet provider is, can't treat those bits differently depending on what they are. The reason the internet works, I keep talking about this level playing field, is that listening to your podcast is just as easy, it loads just as fast as listening to anything else, any megacorp, something that has a multi-billion dollar
budget.
That
fucker Ira Glass with This American
like Ira,
Life.
This
yes.
guy.
That son of a bitch.
God. And so here's an opportunity for you to have a totally level playing field. You can win based on the merit of the podcast, not because of the budget of incumbents. And our internet providers want nothing more than to be able to extract as many profits as they can. And look, their company's okay. But they want to do so in a manner that would break the internet because it would give incumbents a kind of advantage that would prohibit new entrants from coming in. And so you can use the Netflix deal with Comcast as a great example. You know, Netflix has now paid for priority, and they've paid the bribe to Comcast so they'd get priority for traffic. Their stuff will load quickly, and speed is everything on the internet. Now, some founder who wants to come to me, and I'm a Netflix shareholder, okay? But some founder who wants to start, she wants to start the next Netflix, right? Innovation, the free market, America, all that stuff works really well because someone with a good idea can win because they've made something better. But now she's probably not going to win because she can't pay for the access that Netflix has been able to pay for. She can't access nearly as much of the market. Her download speeds are not going to be as fast. Like she now gets deprioritized into a slow lane. And it goes against everything that has allowed so many great ideas to flourish online. And so if we get net neutrality right, we all know internet is a utility, right? Like electricity, cannot live without internet. It's funny, even like our landline telephones are treated as a Title II, a common carrier utility. How much of a utility is your landline versus your internet? Think about that, America. That's why this is a no-brainer for everyone in America, except for our ISPs who have, you know, made the right lobbying hires. To make this an issue with the FCC. You can research this, go Google around, you'll find all the information you need, and make sure we don't screw this up because I don't I don't know what I'd do with myself.
Right.
I wouldn't have a career. I wouldn't have
photos. You could go work for AT&T.
That's true, or Comcast.
Yeah.
And that's the best part because part of their defense, part of like the Comcast Verizon defense is, oh, well, trust us. Trust us, we're not. Really? You guys might actually have lower approval ratings than Congress right now. And I can't even trust you to like send your cable guy on time. And you want me to trust you with keeping the internet a level playing field? No way in hell.
The kind of misidentification of the Boston bomber that happened on Reddit and caused a huge kerfuffle.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with misinformation on the internet? We've just seen a ruling in Europe where people can now expunge their own sort of virtual identity online.
Yes.
This seems to be a growing problem.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do about it?
There's no easy answer. What happened with the misidentification of the Boston bomber was awful. Some random users started posting up suspicions about who it might be when the FBI was like, hey, help us identify these suspects. And one of the threads got picked up. A few people start tweeting about it. A few journalists start writing about it. And all of a sudden, everything just goes wrong for this innocent young man and his family. this is the challenge, right? Where everyone has, and this is a problem with social media, everyone has a megaphone now, and it's a gift and a curse. It means marginalized voices now have a megaphone that they can use to get news and information out they wouldn't normally have been able to. And it means that anyone can write something. We saw it during, even during Sandy, there was that guy who was mistweeting or was tweeting false information about what was going on with the relief efforts. Like, there's no easy answer. And so I know one of the things that came about as a result of what happened on Reddit was a sort of, again, it's difficult to, you can't 100% enforce it, but as much as we can to curb this kind of
wild speculation.
Or like the trying to track down and identify a person, right? Mm. If that kind of threat happens, all of the volunteer moderators who run subreddits will sort of block or ban that post. But like I said, the challenge is, right, you can, let's say you can squelch it on Reddit, but let's say it bubbles up on Twitter, or you squelch it on Twitter and it bubbles up on Facebook, you squelch it. I mean, it's to be, we have to be totally intellectually honest about this. It is difficult because this is a kind of flaw of humanity, where we have this problem. And now we have these amazing enabling tools, and yet they just amplify our good and our bad.
Right. I was hoping you were going to say we should just have more censorship. Because that's my solution.
No. And this is the challenge. I do believe there are more good people in this world. I do believe there is more good in this world. And in the end, it does triumph. But this is the new responsibility we have.
As we head towards the home stretch here, can you give me the best advice and worst advice that you've received?
Wow. In just like life advice?
Me, either life, professionally.
Okay. All right, I'll give you the best.
Could be relationship. I don't care what it is.
Okay. The best advice that I've received was from, so my mom, when I was a little kid, she used to tell me, and you have to imagine, I could do her German accent probably, because she was, like I said, she was fresh off the boat from Germany. So she's like, your father and I, she didn't actually sound like that. I'm getting a little stereotypical, but
it's a little left troopy, but I like it.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Your father
so
and I.
So your father and I, we don't always know what's best. I just want you to know that. And so you have to live your life for who you are and figure it out because, you know, we don't know. No one knows. And I appreciated that even as like an angsty teenager with like a Rammstein shirt on. And I was that kid with the middle part and the long, it was not a good look. I appreciated that because she demystified for me really early on that, like, really no one knows what the fuck they're doing. Not even your parents. Not even the ones who have that weird kind of artificial authority thing over you. Like, don't get me wrong. You don't upset a German woman. You don't break curfew on a German. There are serious repercussions for that. But even she conceded, like, no one really knows. And that's advice I've always gone to in one form or another. Because the more I meet people who are doing amazing stuff, the more I realize, really, no one knows what the fuck they're doing. Even Jay-Z and Beyonce wake up in the morning and, I mean, on their piles of money. And actually, they probably don't even need to sleep. They just
they just levitate.
Yeah. You know, there is none of us, there really is no blueprint to all this. We really are all hacking it. And no one person is a total authority figure on anything. Like we're just all carbon-based life forms figuring shit out together. And that has served me really well because it's demystified a lot of things for me. And the worst advice I ever got, wow, who am I going to put on blast here? What was the worst advice I'd ever gotten? Oh, well, I don't, well, let's see here.
That sounded good. That sounded very promising to me.
I was an undergrad business major as well. And I had a professor there who had, I had dyed my hair green during, junior year of college. I don't know why. I just always wanted green hair. And he told me, he was like, what do you really want to do with your life? Because you seem to, you know, have some like issues. And he's like, really, what's going on? And I was like, I really don't know. And at this time, I think I had just started the transition to like starting a company. And I was like, I think, I don't know, I might start a company with my buddy Steve. And he's like, I don't know why on earth you would want to do that. That is a terrible idea. Just don't even bother. And I was like, wow. That's really great advice. Thanks a lot. I'm going to listen to this every day.
Let me squelch your dream right here, son. Well, you've got green hair.
I was a little disruptive. To paint a fair picture, I was not a model student in that finance class. But I think one of the things I've been so fortunate to have is I had two awesome parents who were extremely supportive and just amazeballs. And that gave me a foundation to throughout life deal with a fair number of people. I'll never forget them because like they're on my wall of negative reinforcement who have told me at one point or another that I was an idiot or that I was going to fail. And obviously everyone has this. Everyone has their haters. Haters going to hate, right? But it's allowed me to have a perspective that's like, you know what? No, this is motivation. These are people who I get to prove wrong and I'm grateful for them because it's something that that still drives me to this day.
What else is on the wall of negative reinforcement? Do you have a literal wall of negative?
I had a wall of negative reinforcement at Reddit. The literal wall started because Steve and I, like five months into Reddit, we're in Boston and we were invited to Yahoo. And it was like Silicon Valley. Oh my God, we're going to the Valley. And we made a mix CD. really, it was a Metallica mix CD. It was a big deal. It was 2005, so mix CDs were a thing. And we went out there for our first trip to the Valley, and this executive at Yahoo was like, hey, come on in. I want to meet you guys and tell us about Reddit. And a few minutes into the meeting, he just cut us off, and he was like, hey, wait, so how much traffic do you guys have anyway? And I looked at Steve, and he looked at me, and we're like, well, 10,000 users a month, or 10,000 users, it's growing week over week. And he's just like, you guys are a rounding error compared to Yahoo. What are you even doing here?
Nice.
And I was like, well, you invited us. Like, is it like a hazing thing you do at Yahoo or you just invite a startup in and then shit on them? Like, and that meeting went really poorly, obviously. So we went back home. And the first thing I did was I put on the wall next to my desk was a little sign that said, you are a rounding error. And I sort of added things to it. Now I have it in a Dropbox folder. So it's high tech now. But it was motivating every morning to look at that guy or look at his quote and try to prove him wrong.
That's what I aspire to be, as a rounding error. I'm not even a rounding error.
No.
At this point. All right. So, Alexis, I have a tradition here on the show, which is I end every How to Be Amazing with something called the Amazing Five, where I ask for your recommendations in five different categories. I'm going to start with film.
Okay. Any film that's amazing?
Any film. Any film that
Aliens.
You love. Aliens, yeah. The sequel to Alien.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. Alien is a better film, but like Aliens just gets me, gets me all warm and fuzzy.
Right.
Yeah.
Blasting Aliens gets you warm and fuzzy.
Yeah.
Good enough?
Yeah.
Music.
Man. Wait, album or artist?
Anything.
I'm the worst. Okay.
No, you're doing great. You're better than some of the others. I'm not going to name names, but some of our other guests, like Elizabeth Gilbert, were terrible.
Oh, man. Okay, well, it defined my entire adolescence in college, which would be Metallica all the way to the Black Album. And then maybe a little bit of Load and Reload, I'm sorry.
So Metallica.
Yeah.
Still into Metallica?
A lot, but I listen to a lot of hip-hop now. A lot of rock got less angry.
Right.
It got a lot less angry, and hip-hop got way angrier, or was always angry, and I like it a lot now.
So turning 30 has not mellowed your inner anger?
No, there's still the angsty. I mean, I'm a happy, don't get me wrong, I'm a really happy person. I mean, hopefully you can tell that from this. Listeners, you can also tell. But I just like, I like music that gets me,
You get like to be pumped.
Jacked up, yeah.
Right. Food.
Ooh. Okay, because it's fresh on my mind because I just went there. Pock Pock.
What's
in
that?
In Brooklyn. Oh, it's amazing. Okay, so it was originally started in Portland, but it's Thai food, and it's like Thai food. It's not just like, here's some pad Thai. It's like Thai food, and it's very good.
Maybe I've never had like Thai food, but
I'm pronouncing it wrong, but larp, it's like diced duck. I think you can also get it in pork too, and it's really diced. It's really spicy. It's just a bunch of things that are basically in Thai. Like it's just like pad Thai is like the kind of like how Chinese food in the States is Americanized. Yeah. Like there is the Thai food, which we all know and love, which is pretty Americanized. Ironically, it's a non-Thai guy who started Pok Pok, but it's still really good.
All right. Pok Pok.
And it's in my hood.
Book?
Oh, Glenn Greenwald's new book, because I just got it and I haven't read it yet.
What's it called?
Oh, God. This is bad.
You don't know.
I'm sorry, Glenn. This is bad.
But is it telling the Edward Snowden story?
Yeah.
No Place to Hide.
No Place to Hide. There we go. Yes. How did you?
Bob knew. Bob
nice.
In the booth.
Thank you. I am. Wow. Blank. This is the stress, man.
I know. This is the most stressful part of the interview.
Okay.
This might be the most stressful one about to come up.
Okay.
Grab bag or potpourri. Anything in your life that you find amazing.
Wow. I'll give some more Brooklyn love. Brooklyn Bridge Park. I walked it this weekend, and I never go. I don't like going outside, if that's not clear from my complexion. And like I said earlier, it's just hard to use a computer in the park. And it's beautiful. And there's this huge development where they've taken a bunch of piers that were dilapidated, and they've turned it into public park space. And you can see families from all over Brooklyn hanging out with their kids. I'm not allowed to get too close to the kids, of course. That's not a me thing. That's a New York thing.
That's a legal thing. I understand.
Yeah, or the park, because you can't if you don't have children. But anyway, it was really nice to walk around there and actually spend time away from a computer. This city is beautiful. Like, New York is a beautiful city.
Well, Alexis Ohanian, thank you so much for being part of How to Be Amazing. You were amazing.
Thank you, Michael. You were amazing.
Oh, you flirt.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @HTBA_show. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. Today's show is mixed and edited by Kristen Clark, with music today from Chad Crouch and Smooth McGroove. I'm Michael Ian Black.